From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Yemen is a war zone. A group called the Houthis are involved. Saudi Arabia is involved. The U.S. is part of the Saudi-led coalition. Civilians have borne the brunt of the violence. Thousands have been injured or killed. There's been a cholera epidemic. Poverty and malnutrition afflict millions of people, large numbers of whom have been internally displaced. Shireen Al-Adimi was born in Yemen and now lives in the U.S., where she works to raise awareness of the ongoing war in Yemen, the roles played by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. in the conflict, and the war's impact on ordinary people. Shireen Al-Adimi recently completed a doctorate in education at Harvard and is now an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. On April 20th, Al-Adimi gave a talk at Loyola University in Chicago. Today we present portions of that presentation, edited by yours truly. Shireen Al-Adimi began her talk with some basic demographic information about Yemen.
The population of Yemen is 28 million people, which is roughly the same population as Saudi Arabia, despite it being a much smaller country. 43% of the population is under 15 years of age. The official language is Arabic. Most of the population is Muslim, with Zaydi Muslims making up approximately 35 to 40% of the population. This will start to be relevant later on when we talk about whether this issue is sectarian or not. And there are small populations of Jewish, Hindu, Christian, and Baha'i groups in Yemen. Poverty in Yemen in 2015, before the war, was already extreme, with over 50% of the population living with less than $2 a day. I don't know what the figures are today, but I'd imagine they're much worse. But while Yemen is economically depressed and is, you know, the Middle East's poorest country, it's rich in many other ways, including its history. So here's a picture of the Temple of the Sun in Ma'rib, Yemen, and this is the Queen of Sheba, if you've heard about Queen of Sheba. She ruled from Yemen, and this is part of the excavation in northern Yemen, Temple of the Sun. There are many other historical sites in Yemen that are over 3,000, 4,000 years old. Yemen also has unique geography. You'll find everything from highlands, deserts, and even exotic beaches. This is the island of Socotra that is south of Yemen, and it's known for its unique biodiversity. We're also known for our architecture, which is very different from other neighboring countries. And for the coffee lovers out there, if you like coffee, you have Yemenis to thank, because while Ethiopians were the first to discover the plant, Yemenis were the first to brew it and then to export it to the rest of the world. And if you're familiar with the name mocha, which now means chocolate coffee combination, the word mocha is a port in Yemen where coffee used to be exported out of. In order to understand what the conflict is and how we got here, it's important to look back at Yemen's modern history. And if you look at an old map, you'll see that Yemen is divided into two portions, north and south. So it's really west and east, but we call it north and south. So northern Yemen, what used to be called northern Yemen, is where 80% of the population lives. And in south Yemen, most of that area is desert, and about 20% of the population lives there. What was called North Yemen was under the control of the Ottoman Empire until the end of World War II. Then they were ruled by the Mutawakkilite Kingdom of Yemen from 1918 until the revolution in 1962, and it became the Yemen Arab Republic from 1962 until 1990, where both South and North Yemen united as one. The socialist country was in the south, South Yemen, with the capital Aden, where I was born. It was under British rule from 1874 to 1963. And following that, it became known as the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. It was a Marxist socialist government. And they united with northern Yemen in 1990 to form the Republic of Yemen, which is what we have now. So unfortunately, the unity between north and south people weren't happy about it. People from the south weren't very happy about it. And within 4 years, a civil war broke out between north and south. The north being the more dominant country, And many people in South Yemen consider that they're living under occupation by the North. And so there's a lot of disenfranchisement, you know, and the alliances that have been forming are still a reflection of what happened in 1994. So oftentimes you'll hear about Yemen being referred to as a civil war. And yes, the crisis in Yemen began as a civil war. It began when various factions were vying for power, and we'll go over that very briefly. But essentially in 2015, with Saudi Arabia's intervention, it can no longer fairly be called a civil war because you have a coalition of international countries, foreign countries, attacking one country, which is Yemen. And so it's still referred to as civil war, but it's a bit misleading to think of it that way. Who's fighting whom and who are the major political groups in Yemen? There is the UN-recognized legitimate president of Yemen, and this is Hadi, President Hadi. He is based in Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, and has been there for the past 3 years. Then there's a group called the Houthi rebels. There's also Yemen's ex-president Saleh, who had ruled the country for 33 years, and he has, until his death in 2017, December 2017, just a few months ago, his party was very dominant in Yemen, and it remains very dominant. There's the Islah Party, which is basically the Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen, and they are connected to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And then there are the separatists in the south who are trying to secede from the north altogether. So a brief Houthi-Saleh history. The Houthis they call themselves Ansarullah, and they're from a northern province of Sa'da. They had been talking, started off preaching in mosques about issues that they had with the Yemeni government. President Saleh was very willing to have Americans come in and drone Yemen, for example. He was willing for the Saudis to intervene in local political conflicts. And this started off as their, a populist movement that was against any foreign intervention. So he saw that as a threat. And even though they're both from the same sect of Zaydi Islam, he waged war against the Houthis in six different wars from 2004 to 2011 and was unsuccessful in defeating them. In fact, they continued to grow in popularity. They ended up joining the opposition in 2011 against Saleh, but then they ended up forming an alliance with him later on. And then when that alliance ended in 2017, it led to clashes that resulted in his death. But essentially, and I'm going to go through a brief timeline shortly, but why is Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen? Well, the Houthis were the only group who was saying, well, we don't want any foreign intervention. And Saudi Arabia, for the first time, was going to lose control in Yemen. It wasn't going to have a government that was willing to support its interests in the region. So they panicked. But the roots can be traced to the 2011 revolution. You've heard of the Arab Spring. Many countries started revolting against the dictators and longtime presidents. And in Yemen, we had a longtime president, 33 years. We'd have elections every now and then, but he would win with 99.9% of the vote. And although he had many supporters, he also had people who were willing to rise up against him. And it's important to note that the Yemeni revolution started off as a peaceful revolution. After the United States, per capita, Yemen is the most armed country after the United States. But this was a peaceful revolution. Unfortunately, this didn't last for very long because members of the Islah Party, who had previously been his allies, ended up joining the opposition and really hijacked the entire revolution, the People's Revolution. And he continued to refuse to step down, and the Islah Party ended up trying to assassinate Saleh. He survived with severe burns, but he survived. And that's when the revolution really ended up being just another power play among people who were, the people were really not just revolting against Saleh, they were revolting against the whole entire system, but the elites, which are the Islah Party, ended up joining the opposition, joining the protesters. So in November, after his assassination attempt, Saleh ended up transferring power to his vice president of 20 years, Hadi. So unlike other Arab Spring presidents, he had a very nice deal worked up with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries where he was to remain in Yemen. He wasn't going to be prosecuted for any crimes that he had committed. And he continued to control the Yemeni army. So Hadi was just an interim president. He was supposed to be there for 2 years. He was supposed to form some kind of unity government and rework the constitution so that everybody, all the different groups who had revolted, could come to some kind of understanding. Well, that didn't work out really, because Heidi just stayed there and didn't do anything. So in September 2014, the Houthis, which was a group that was also frustrated by what was happening, the lack of action, they decided to take over the capital, Sana'a. And it wasn't really very, it wasn't a bloody clash, because the Yemeni army did not intervene. And this was very surprising, because the Houthis and the Saleh's party were longtime enemies. But Saleh, I think, saw this as an opportunity to maybe regain some kind of power. And so he allowed the Houthis to take over Sana'a without much intervention from his army. And that month, the Houthis and the Hadi government, they signed a unity agreement, an agreement to form a unity government. So things were still looking good up until that point. That, you know, the Houthis were trying to force some action, but, you know, things were going to work out. Well, Hadi ended up resigning. First of all, his term, his two-year term was up, and then he resigned. And then he decided that he wasn't, you know, he changed his mind about the resignation, and then he fled to Aden. So the Houthis went chasing him, and within days, Saudi Arabia began bombing Yemen. And since, this is actually a picture of Fajr al-Thani bombing. It was, they had targeted a weapons depot that was right in the heart of a residential area. 150 people died, and the anniversary is actually the third anniversary is today. So the Saudi Arabia formed a coalition very quickly, and there was a lot of confusion about, well, who was in the coalition. At some point, they added Pakistan to the coalition, and Pakistan was like, we're not in the coalition, right? And so the decision to attack Yemen came 2 months after King Salman took power and appointed his son, Mohammed bin Salman, as the deputy crown prince at the time. He's now crown prince and defense minister. And Mohammed bin Salman, he's this unknown person, wanted to kind of, you know, present himself to the international community. And he figured that he could bomb Yemen for 2 weeks, reinstate Hadi to power, and get rid of the Houthis, and it'll all be over. Here we are 3 years later. So who's in the coalition? Many countries have formed joined the coalition. They're led by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Qatar was in the coalition up until they were expelled in June of last year after their spat with Saudi Arabia. Bahrain, Kuwait, Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, Sudan, and Senegal.
That's Shireen Al-Adeimi giving a talk about Yemen and the ongoing war ravaging that country. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Shireen, who was born in Yemen and now lives in the United States, works to raise awareness about Yemen and the ongoing war there and the war's causes and consequences. We return now to more of her talk. Here, Shireen Al-Adeimi discusses what the Houthis stand for.
I think they started off as just trying to raise more awareness among the Yemeni population about not having control over their own destiny. But they were also, I mean, the province where they're from, you know, here we have a president who's, the UN says, has $60 billion is his net worth.
Saleh.
And, you know, is one of the richest men on the planet. But and the poorest country in the Middle East, and one of the poorest countries in the world, and they don't even have electricity in their province. They don't even have running water in many places. And so they were challenging, you know, the corruption that was in Yemen. And because they were openly challenging it, he saw it as a threat. So he tried to get the Saudis to help him, you know, fight off the Houthis, and then he tried to get the Americans to help him by actually telling them, oh, look, they're allied with Iran. And so that was his trick, which ended up sticking. The alliance with Iran is very shaky. There's not much evidence of really concrete ways that the Iranians have been helping. But that's how it started. And the more wars he waged on the Houthis, the more really Yemeni started becoming aware of them, and they gained more popularity that way.
And here, Shireen Al-Adeimi discusses the extent to which Shia-Sunni dynamics play a role in the conflict in Yemen.
That's what Saudi Arabia says, that they're fighting off, you know, Shia Iran in Yemen, and the Houthis are Shia. Well, Houthis are Zaydi Shias, yes, but so was President Saleh. And he was a longtime ally of Saudi Arabia. And he had fought against the Houthis in six wars. So it's really not a sectarian issue in Yemen. It's you know, it's a regional issue. There's, you know, the north-south divide plays into it, but not the sectarianism that you hear about in the news. There are also some partners in this war against Yemen. And by partners, I mean these are the countries like US, UK, and France that provide logistical support, training of the troops, and so on. And then countries like Eritrea, Djibouti, and Somalia, who have made their airspaces and their bases available to the Saudi-led coalition. And then, of course, there are weapon suppliers, and this is not a comprehensive list. They have played significant role, of course, and have enriched themselves from this war on Yemen. So you have countries like Canada that had its biggest arms deals ever with the Saudi Arabians during the war on Yemen. Countries like Germany and the Netherlands have recently stopped weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, but many others continue to sell weapons. So this is a point that I want to make because for many Yemenis, it really makes no sense that the United States is helping Saudi Arabia, given Saudi Arabia's relationship with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Okay? And given the United States' goals of trying to get rid of Al-Qaeda in Yemen through drone strikes that have been going on for the past decade or so. So the BBC actually recorded troops from Saudi-led coalition forces and Al-Qaeda militias working together against the Houthis. And Frontline did a documentary too, and you can see evidence there. It's no secret in Yemen that whenever convenient, the Saudi-led coalition works with Al-Qaeda against the Houthis. President Hadi, the UN-recognized president of Yemen, whose term expired and somehow he's still stuck being our president, he has appointed Naif al-Qaisi, who is a U.S.-designated terrorist, as a governor of one of the provinces in Yemen. And there are many more links between Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, and the Saudi-led coalition, and I've just listed a couple of sources here that I can share with you if anybody's interested, if you want to dig further into this. So for many Yemenis, it's a very confusing thing. The only people who are known to fight Al-Qaeda successfully were the Houthis, and now the Houthis are busy fighting everybody else. So what has this war done? What is the impact of the war on Yemen after 3 years? Well, if you look at who controls what, you see that after 3 years, Houthis still control that green areas where about 80% of the population lives, and it's mostly under Houthi control. And the Saudis share the rest of Yemen with Al-Qaeda. And if this looks a bit familiar, you can see that it's along the regional north-south divide. Because what happened in southern Yemen, he saw this as an opportunity to rid themselves of northern Yemen. And so they thought, maybe the Saudis will help us secede from Yemen when all is said and done. And so they supported the Saudi-led coalition. Well, now it seems that Saudi Arabia has an agenda, and United Arab Emirates has a different agenda in Yemen. And the UAE has been trying to, foster this separatist movement, whereas Saudi Arabia is still trying to hope for a united Yemen under President Hadi. The impact of the war on people, on people's everyday lives, has been substantial. Today, over 80% of the population needs humanitarian aid. The UN stopped counting the deaths resulting from airstrikes in January 2017, even though there are airstrikes every single day, including an airstrike today that killed 14 people. But the official figure is 10,000 people killed. 16.4 million lack access to health care. Saudi Arabia has bombed most hospitals. About 45% of hospitals remain functioning, somewhat functioning. Yemen experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak, with over 1 million people infected. At the height of the cholera outbreak in Haiti, which I'm sure you've heard about, it was about 700,000 people. There are over 3 million civilians who are displaced internally because there's nowhere to go. Have you heard of Yemeni refugees in Europe? Probably not, because there's a land, air, and sea blockade that's keeping people in the country. It's 24.3 million people, about 90% lack access to electricity. So most of Yemen has had no electricity for the past 3 years. They use solar power, they use generators, which, Saudi Arabia bombed a generator plant yesterday. Yemen was already water-stressed before this conflict even began, and now 15.7 million people lack access to clean water. Just in 2016 and 2017, 113,000 children died of malnutrition and preventable diseases like cholera and diphtheria. And millions lack access to fuel. Think about how important fuel is to our everyday lives. Millions lack access to it, and many cities have run out of fuel entirely. So when the UN says that this is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, it is not an exaggeration. There's a land, air, and sea blockade, like I said, and Saudi Arabia has admitted to be using starvation as a weapon of war. This is, in case you didn't know, a war crime, among many other war crimes that they're committing. And like I said, they've destroyed many hospitals, including four separate bombings on Doctors Without Borders hospitals in Yemen. This is after they were giving them coordinates, exact coordinates, to say we are Doctors Without Borders. Schools, homes, markets, water plants, and even funeral homes like this have been targeted by the Saudi-led coalition. This particular bomb killed 150 people. They were attending a funeral. So let's talk about the U.S. role in Yemen. Yemen controls Bab al-Mandab Strait, where 3.4 or 3.8 million barrels of oil travel each day. This is Saudi oil, right? And so it has a strategic location. This isn't very many millions barrels of oil compared to other places, but it's still significant enough that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia want to maintain control over that area. Sometimes you hear about Yemen in the news when there's a drone strike. Like in January 2017, when Trump was first elected, there was an incident there that, you know, there was a U.S. SEAL, Navy SEAL involved. So that is a different front of the war. So the U.S. is involved in two ways. One is mostly drone strikes on suspected terrorists, which, by the way, include American citizens in Yemen. And the second is assisting the Saudi-led coalition, which is what's been going on in the last 3 years. So the U.S. has continued, of course, to supply weapons in the hundreds of billions worth ever since the Obama administration. And this is just, you know, you hear sometimes about U.S. involvement being that they're, you know, in the sense that they're providing weapons, but that's not the whole story. So the United States Army trains Saudi soldiers. They advise Saudi military personnel. They maintain, repair, and upgrade vehicles and aircraft. They provide courses on communication, navigation, and, quote, how to lead by example. This is from a U.S. Army article that was published in January of this year. There are 123 contracts with the Saudis that total $120 million per month. These are all the training and the advising and the repairing and all of that. And I think most significantly, the U.S. refuels Saudi jets mid-air as they're bombing all of these civilian targets that they've been bombing over the last 3 years. Simply put, Saudi cannot continue to wage war on Yemen without the significant support that they're receiving from the United States. Here in the United States, there have been some really promising legislations introduced in both the House and the Senate, and just in the last few months. So in October 2017, HCON Resolution 81 was introduced by Congressman Ro Khanna of California, and he invoked the War Powers Act, which meant that it had to go to a vote within 15 days. And instead, it was stripped of its privileged status and never went to a vote. Instead, they replaced it with another vote, with another bill that passed, but it overstated Iran's role in Yemen, and then they started talking about, well, let's sanction Iran some more because they're somehow involved in Yemen. It was non-binding. It did, however, acknowledge that the war, U.S. involvement in Yemen is without congressional support and approval. Then in February 2018, Senator Bernie Sanders introduced SJ Resolution 54, also invoked the War Powers Act. And he said, we believe that as Congress has not declared war or authorized military force in this conflict, the United States involvement in Yemen is unconstitutional and unauthorized, and U.S. military support of the Saudi coalition must end. Well, they decided to table it in the Senate. They didn't even vote on this bill. 44% voted not to table it. It doesn't mean that they if it had gone to a vote, that they would have voted for it. Going in, Bernie Sanders had 14 co-sponsors of the bill. So yes, 44% seems like a big deal, but let's remember that they were voting to not table the bill. In the end, 55% voted to table the bill, and that was that. So I asked some Yemenis, I said to them, what would you want to tell an American audience? One person said, I want Americans to know that without U.S. government support, the Saudi regime is not able to launch the war and impose siege on Yemen. In every single Saudi war crime in Yemen, the U.S. government is involved. In Yemen, this is not just seen as a Saudi Arabian war on Yemen, this is seen as a U.S.-Saudi war on Yemen. In America, we don't even know where Yemen is. Another person says, if Yemenis survive U.S.-supported airstrikes, they'll die from lack of food or medicine. Put yourself in the shoes of the Yemeni population when your child sleeps without food and cannot find medicine. Yemeni civilians suffer the brunt of this war. 80% of civilians are suffering. The decision to stop the war is in the hands of the United States government, first and foremost.
You are listening to portions of a talk that Shireen Al-Adeimi gave about the ongoing war in Yemen. Al-Adeimi, who is a Yemeni activist and an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University, spoke in Chicago in April. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We turn now to excerpts from the question and answer portion of her presentation. We begin with Shireen answering a question from an audience member about the involvement of other countries in the war in Yemen.
Israel, not that I know of. Russia tried to play a peacekeeping role at some point. The Russian ambassador was the only foreign ambassador left in Sana'a for the longest time. But they didn't play any major role. China, not as far as I know. Iran is what you hear about a lot in the news. Just type Yemen and you'll see U.S. or Iran-backed Houthis. I mean, that's just become standard. That's the narrative. Like I said earlier, this connection began with Saleh. And, you know, he tried to get the Americans to help him with the Houthi problem. And so he thought, well, if I tell the Americans that Iran is involved, maybe they'll be responsive. And the U.S. ambassador at the time did his own investigation to see where the Houthis' weapons were coming from, because Saleh was saying that they were coming from Iran. And they found that they were all coming from the Yemeni army through the black market. I mean, I joke about this, but when we were kids, we used to say, well, if you want to buy a tank in Yemen, you can buy a tank in Yemen. The Houthis ended up forming a relationship with Iranians. The Iranians very much see themselves as allies of the Houthis, and they definitely provide support on the media front. At times before this war, before this intervention, there had been advisors that were exchanged between, you know, the Houthi advisors and Iranian advisors. They were meeting and discussing things. But currently, Yemen is under blockade by the most powerful countries in the world, and we're led to believe that somehow Iran is smuggling missiles to Yemen through the U.S.-Saudi blockade on everything around the whole country. So that makes no sense. There's been no evidence of that. Nikki Haley, you know, will show a missile and say, this is Iranian. It's not. It's from Yemen. They've tried, at the beginning of the war, an Iranian ship tried to provide some humanitarian assistance, and the Saudis blocked them, and so they went back. So really, they're not involved. You won't find military, you know, Iranian personnel on the ground. If they were involved, you'd think that at least they'd provide the Houthis with anti-missile aircraft, but we don't even have that. And so it's a shaky argument, but it's one that has solidified because that's what the Saudis are saying they're there for.
And here she says more things about the Houthis and their relationship to Iran.
So the Houthis have nothing to do, they will not answer to U.S. or any foreigners, really. They have a relationship with Iran, but even that relationship is strained. For example, when the Houthis at some point during this war were trying to negotiate directly with the Saudi Arabians in Saudi Arabia, and some Iranian general said, oh, if you need advisors, we're happy to send. And the Houthis were very offended at that and said, this is not your war, stay out of it, we don't want any advice. Iranian officials say that they advised the Houthis not to take over Sana'a. Houthis ignored it. Because again, part of their rise to power and the movement is that they don't want foreign intervention in their country. So I don't think they ever intended to govern, which is why when Hadi resigned, so they were, when they marched to Sana'a and they took over Sana'a, they had surrounded the presidential palace and were trying to force Hadi to do something. Oh, you know, you've been you know, your term expired and you haven't done anything, we're going to sit here and watch you do it, right? He ended up fleeing to Aden. They chased him to Aden because they weren't trying to rule Sana'a. They were trying to, you know, form this unity government so that they could have a say just like everybody else, right? The Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen, the Islah Party, the Saleh's Party, the Southern Separatists. They were trying to have some control in Yemen like everybody else, but I don't think they ever intended to govern. They're fighters. They do that best. So Sana'a's population was 3 million, now it's 6 million, because most people have gone to Sana'a, because Sana'a is the safest place to be. Because, yes, there are airstrikes every single day, but there's no Al-Qaeda. Why is there no Al-Qaeda? Because of the Houthis. And so, in a way, they appreciate that the Houthis have brought the security, but they also oppose them because they're either loyal to President Saleh or they're just, you know, the Houthis obviously have blood on their hands as well. And so people are just kind of tired of all of these different factions vying for power. They don't really, if there was an election, if you had asked me in December 2017, who would people vote for if there was an election, I would have said President Saleh. Now President Saleh is dead. So I have no idea. It's a big question mark. I think the Houthi support has grown over the years, but you know, I don't know to what extent. A lot of people also just don't want to talk about it, so it's difficult.
And here Shireen Al-Adeemi answers a question about the stance taken by the United Nations vis-a-vis the war in Yemen. After that, you'll hear her comment on Yemeni Americans and where their sentiments lie. And finally, she talks about Saudi Arabia's ability to conduct military operations without the assistance and guidance of the U.S.
I hope that the United Nations has a role in that. So far, it doesn't look like there is a role for the United Nations, because the United Nations, under Resolution 2216, approves of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. And so, at some point in 2016, the United Nations designated Saudi as, you know, as a child killer. It's a shame list, right? They put them on the list of child killers because of their, you know, they're murdering children in Yemen. And within 72 hours, they took them off that list. And the general, Ban Ki-moon at the time, made an announcement. He said, I've had to make these very difficult decisions because the Saudis threatened to pull aid away from Gaza and Syria and other programs. And so he took them, removed them from the list. He put them on the list and took them out within 72 hours. His successor ended up putting them back on the list. So I think currently they're on the list. But just recently, 2 weeks ago, the Saudis met with the current UN Secretary General, and he was praising them left, right, and center for their incredible donation for the humanitarian aid in Yemen, right? And so, you know, there's nobody in the UN really representing Yemeni interests. The people we have in the UN, Yemenis in the UN, are based out of Saudi Arabia. They're getting, you know, their salaries are from Saudi Arabian government. And they are perpetuating this agenda of war on Yemen. So there are huge Yemeni populations in New York, in Dearborn, Detroit area, and in Oakland, California. Most people support the intervention. And I get called, you know, I get accused of being a Houthi supporter, and, you know, all the time for speaking out against Saudi intervention in Yemen. Many of the Yemeni diaspora in the U.S. is affiliated with the Islah Party in Yemen. And, you know, the Islah Party, up until Qatar was involved in the war, they were for the war. Now that Qatar is out, they're like, oh, we shouldn't really be doing this. And so there's a lot of splintering. There's splinters in families. There are members of my family that support the Saudi-led intervention. And so it's really a war that's divided a lot of people. But in Yemen, most people are against the Saudi-led intervention, no matter where their political affiliations lie. The Saudis couldn't even protect their own capital from Houthi missiles. They were shooting anti-aircraft missiles, and they bombed themselves. And so this just happened a month ago. I'm not joking. There's video evidence of this. And Reuters wrote about it. So the Houthis depend on, or sorry, the Saudi Arabians depend on U.S. support. You know, substantial U.S. support. Military, blockade, intelligence, training, equipment. The Saudi military doesn't have troops on the ground in Yemen, okay? You will not find a Saudi soldier in Yemen. You know who you'll find? Senegalese, Sudanese mercenaries, Blackwater operatives, Australians, Colombians, Yemenis that they've paid off. They don't send their own troops to Yemen. So they can't even send troops to Yemen, right? So they can't operate their aircraft. They can't maintain their aircraft. They can't do any logistical support. They can't. They have UK and US personnel in their targeting rooms, right? So they can. They literally cannot continue to wage war without US and UK support.
And that's Shireen Al-Adeimi, a Yemeni activist who was born in Yemen and who works to raise awareness about the U.S.-supported Saudi-led war on and in Yemen since 2015. Shireen Al-Adeimi, that's spelled Shireen Al-Adeimi, has a doctorate in education from Harvard, and she is an assistant professor of education at Michigan State University. Thanks to the folks at WZRD in Chicago for recording the event. We'll take a music break and return with portions of an interview with Amy Sueyoshi that were not aired last week. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Last week, we presented an interview with Amy Sueyoshi about her new book, Discriminating Sex, White Leisure and the Making of the American, quote, Oriental. Because of a technical glitch, the last 10 minutes or so of the interview were not broadcast last Wednesday, so we are presenting those portions with a bit of an overlap now. Amy Sueyoshi is interim dean of the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State University. In Discriminating Sex, she examines the creation of the, quote, Oriental in the context of turn of the 20th century San Francisco. She links stereotypes of Chinese and Japanese people to white folks' examination of their own changing gender and sexual norms. Here's a portion of my conversation with Amy Sueyoshi. You spoke earlier briefly about the image of the Japanese man at a certain point as being genteel and feminine in comparison with the Chinese male. And then you said, I believe, that kind of people didn't really have a problem with that in San Francisco, that femininity was not considered, you know, oh, men can't be feminine because that compromises their masculinity in some important way, which actually kind of surprises me. Wasn't there a kind of defensive masculinity that would not like to or want to admit that femininity or, quote, feminine characteristics as they were perceived play a role in how a man carries himself?
So during this time period, men were increasingly entering the office, white-collar work, leaving sort of agrarian as well as what we imagine as blue-collar work. And these are sort of middle-class whites who were born in America. And at the same time, there was an influx of not just Asian immigrants, but also what came in larger numbers were Eastern European immigrants who white folks who were middle-class saw as kind of burly. As well as sort of Southern Italians are also coming into the U.S. And so there's a way in which middle-class white men decided that, oh, maybe they need to reclaim a little bit of this more rugged masculinity as they're becoming more and more civilized into what we imagine today as white-collar work. So for men at this time, there's definitely a balance between feminine and masculine traits. And the best men are considered men who are not basically what we imagine as brutes today, right? Men who can be just and fair and reasonable and not have a temper and not be overly kind of authoritarian or try to force their way through brute strength. And what's interesting for me was that there's a way in which today we think that being effeminate, if you're a man, is bad, right? To have feminine traits is a bad thing, right? There's this culture of masculinity today that is inflexible to allow, you know, feminine traits. But in the 1890s, early 1900s, in fact, Japanese men were seen as being able to balance femininity and masculinity in this artistic and amazing way. It doesn't mean that Japanese men then got jobs as museum curators and art decorators. In fact, that was completely contrary to the case as to where Japanese men fit into the labor force in San Francisco at the time. But it did mean that white folks had this, white men in particular, had this way to tap into femininity, into their construction of their own masculinity. We see this also in the national publication of this book called The Bisexual Man by Buzzacott and Wymore. And The Bisexual Man was not about bisexuality the way we imagine it today. This means like sort of fluid attraction to both men and women, but rather that a single man would have both male and female sexual organs as well as traits. And it was specifically a bisexual man, not a bisexual woman. The people at the time believed that a bisexual woman was mannish and unattractive and a freak of nature. But a bisexual man, in fact, would allow it so that men would not have to deal with difficulties with women because they could now just be self-sustaining and reproduce on their own. And this book actually had popularity in San Francisco. And folks liked the book and they gave it positive reviews. And it's another piece of evidence towards the ways in which people thought of masculinity in some ways a more kind of gender diverse way than we imagine it today.
You have a chapter in this book, Amy, about Chinese prostitutes in San Francisco, or at least how they were depicted at the turn of the 20th century. Tell us about that and about what was happening with youth culture in San Francisco at around the same time.
So Chinese women in San Francisco are at an all-time low in terms of their population. There's also some data through the census that shows that Chinese, quote, prostitutes are, in fact, even at a lower all-time low. And so there's, in fact, very, very few Chinese women, and very few numbers of those Chinese women are actually involved in sex work. At the same time, there's tons of white women flowing into San Francisco for an opportunity to participate in sex work. San Francisco was seen at that time to be a place where sex work was accepted and also regulated. So it's not that everybody thought sex work was great, but rather that the city, to some degree, allowed sex work to flourish. It would line the pockets of local authorities, including the police, but also the public health folks would actually regulate it and allow clinics to do exams on sex workers to make sure that they were healthy and they would have to have a card of health. And the other thing that's going on is that women actually are, young women are actually making out with men underneath street lamps and on street corners. And people are starting to see sort of a blurring of sex work and also dating. Right. So basically, you know, and feminists have argued this as well since the 1970s. But if you imagine that you go out on a date with a guy, right, and he pays for your meal, and then, you know, you end up kissing him or he gets to sort of, you know, fondle you or whatnot, that, you know, one could construe that as a form of exchange, right? Monetary exchange for then physical intimacy. And that exchange made some moralists very nervous. Like maybe dating in and of itself was sex work. And so with the rise of women coming into San Francisco for actual sex work, as well as young people's dating practices changing and, you know, kind of becoming part of the mainstream, right? That there was also this proliferation of images of evil, immoral Chinese prostitutes when Chinese women engaged in sex work were actually at an all-time low.
So what's then behind that? Is it a way of targeting some other population in order to make a point with the white population?
I think that there are a number of theorists who would say that this anxiety around sexuality is then projected onto a racial other, such as the Chinese. What I am trying to do is underscore how dating is part of leisure, like talking about dating is part of leisure. It's titillating, right? Talking about sex work coming into the city is also a part of leisure culture, right? It's also titillating. And then also talking about Chinese prostitutes is super titillating. And so all of this becomes part of this leisure culture that both stimulates and engages white folks in San Francisco as issues of changing sexual mores as well as rising sex work comes to the fore.
Yeah, and stepping back a little bit, because, you know, the title of your book is Discriminating Sex, White Leisure, and the Making of the American, quote, Oriental. Part of your argument is that leisure culture, reading fiction and poetry, attending theater and other performances, did more than just entertain people, right?
Yes, that's correct. That leisure culture, in fact, created this structure of racialization as well as stereotyping.
I mean, and can we say that, can we go as far as saying that this sort of gender and sexual liberation, or at least exploration in San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century, is directly tied not just to racial denigration, but the denigration of Asians, of Asian Americans?
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly what I would argue, is that sort of white gender and sexual exploration and expansion, in fact, created this American, quote, Oriental.
So, Amy, you begin the last section of your book with a description of a police investigation into a, quote, vice ring in San Francisco. This is an investigation that began with a police raid in early 1918. What did the police uncover, and why do you find it significant?
So at 2525 Baker Street, there were a number of men who were inviting other men into their home. And on the first floor, they would sing songs from musicals. Sometimes they would dress up as women and share poetry. And upstairs, they would engage in sex acts, oral sex as well as anal sex. And the police busted what they called a, quote, fellatio ring at 2525 Baker Street. And there were two flats on Baker Street that were rented by two men who we might today call gay. They didn't identify as gay at the time. They called themselves temperamental, as well as queer, believe it or not. And this is one example of how gender and sexual exploration, expansion and exploration for white folks also was projected onto both Japanese and Chinese in the creation of the American Oriental. The reason I argue that 2525 Baker Street and the fellatio ring was central to the creation of the American Oriental was that, in fact, Asians, or the idea of Asians, played a central role in facilitating same-sex community and a modern gay identity in San Francisco.
How so?
Men would pick each other up along Geary Street, and the signal was that if you were peering into a window that was selling, quote, Oriental vases or Oriental art, you would know that this fella was likely, quote, temperamental. And so then you would have a conversation with him. You might invite him out for a drink. But if things got clear very quickly, you would then invite him to a lodging house in Chinatown, because the Chinese were not upset about these types of things. They would permit it to occur in their lodging house. And so, you know, those two men might go to a Chinese lodging house to cuddle, or they would go to, quote, the Oriental bathhouse. And there are something like 25 bathhouses in San Francisco, but these men would go specifically to the, quote, Oriental bathhouses. And the other interesting layer of this is that many of these men were moneyed men driving around what they called machines at the time, which were actually just cars. They were members of the prestigious and elite Bohemian Club as well. So they were definitely the most respectable and often the most powerful members of San Francisco society, picking up, each other as well as young artists, as well as soldiers who were staying in the Presidio during World War I.
To what extent did Asians play a role in the Baker Street Club's activities?
As far as my research reveals, there were no specific Asians involved in the Baker Street activities, though the police claim that they planted a Chinese servant to take notes. And so the existence of a Chinese servant to sort of be at 2525 Baker Street without suspicion, is also another marker of sort of how Asians could be seen as facilitating same-sex sexuality.
Amy Sueyoshi is her name. She is a professor in race and resistance studies and in sexuality studies at San Francisco State University, where she is interim dean of the College of Ethnic Studies. She's the author of Queer Compulsions, Race, Nation, and Sexuality in the Affairs of Yona Noguchi. And she is author of, and we've been discussing this book this hour, Discriminating Sex, White Leisure, and the Making of the American, quote, Oriental. Amy, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you, CS.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.